Still on Credit Suisse, the shotgun wedding of UBS and Credit Suisse has achieved its objective to secure financial system stability. Finance advisor Pete Whitman told Reuters on Monday. Bank stocks rallied on Monday yesterday and a cross-asset scramble for safety abated as investors heaved a tentative sigh of relief that a historic weekend rescue of financial heavyweight Credit Suisse is containing the banking crisis for now. But, said Pete Whitman, chairman of Porta Advisors, the damage done is big and is just the start of it.
Well, this was a shotgun wedding with the objective to secure financial system stability that has been achieved. I think policymakers in the US last week and also in Switzerland over the weekend have achieved that goal. But right now, of course, there will be one bank out of two banks, even larger, and the post-merger integration will be a big challenge in terms of business model, strategy, leadership, and then, of course, also of significant overlaps in domestic business in Switzerland, so you can expect that there will be a political fallout, particularly as we have general elections this fall in Switzerland. The damage is big and it's just the start of it. Moving on from here onwards, you know, it will be key how policymakers and the leaderships, the boards and the banks will implement the decisions of the weekend within the overall Swiss and European context.
German banking expert Thomas Hartmann Wendels said yesterday that the distress of the Credit Suisse has damaged the confidence in the banking system as a whole. Hartmann Wendels considered the takeover of Credit Suisse by UBS to be the only available alternative to nationalizing the bank. In a global response not seen since the height of the pandemic, the US Federal Reserve said it had joined central banks in Canada, England, Japan and the EU, the Switzerland and many more in a coordinated action to enhance market liquidity over the weekend. Hartmann Wendels also argued that the action showed central banks were willing to stabilize the banking system.
Well, the most decisive thing in banking is confidence. The confidence of the depositors, of investors in the stability of the bank, in the stability of the whole financial system. And the financial distress of the Credit Suisse has the effect that confidence has been lost, and this is a damage to the whole banking system, also to other banks. Well, the takeover of the Credit Suisse by UBS was the only available alternative, or the other thing would have been that the bank has been nationalized, which would be even worse. Now the UBS will be an even larger bank, and this is the problem. I remember that after the last financial crisis in 2007-2008, there was a saying, if a bank is too big to fail, then it is certainly too big. But now we still have such big banks that a failure of such a bank is not a viable option.
It would be even worse.
So here to help us unpack and understand the industry a little bit better is Wong Wai Kan, country manager of Stashaway Malaysia. Kan, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Let's do a quick recap of what's happening to the banking industry. I'm not just talking about Credit Suisse. I'm also talking about, say, for instance, the Silicon Valley Bank and many more. Are these type of banks facing the same problems or the same issues?
Good morning, Ibrahim. So, well, I can say the butterfly effect has already started. And it all started when the Fed hikes rates at an unprecedented rate. Something's going to break. So while they're related, they're not the same. SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, is more of a failure of asset liability management. And they underwent what's called a technical failure when the regulators stepped in, when their bond holdings fell by too much last year. So coming to the matter of hand with regards to Credit Suisse, after a series of debacles, including investment schemes that have failed, Archegos, corruption, laundering money and for Bulgarian drug dealers, you name it, they've infringed it. So after the SEC cited material weakness in its annual reports, fear of weak banks which already existed in the markets thanks to SVB turned to panic. But I think the nail in the coffin really came when its larger shareholder, the Saudi investment authorities, said it would not invest anymore in the company. And that caused the stock to fall by 31% and caused a lot of deposits to outflow from the bank.
With regards to Credit Suisse, what was the so-called rescue plan that was executed?
Yeah, so it's quite technical, but the main terms of the deal is that UBS is to acquire Credit Suisse in a share swap for a valuation of $3.2 billion. And this is, as you said earlier, a shadow of what it used to be worth at $90 billion. So, but whether UBS is getting Credit Suisse on the cheap or for a bargain, so to speak, is too early to tell. On top of that, the Swiss government will also provide almost $9 billion to backstop the losses resulting from the takeover. You never know what's really in the bank until you assume all the assets and liabilities, and some may be toxic. So that's what the backstop is for. On top of that, the Swiss National Bank, which is the central bank, will provide $100 billion in liquidity to help UBS to facilitate this deal. So those are the broad terms of the deal.
All right. Why then did investors still lose confidence after the plan was done?
Yes, well, that it's twofold, right? So the Credit Suisse investors in the equity portion are still not convinced, whereas the UBS shareholders seem to have come around to thinking that this is a good deal. Its share price ended positively last night, whereas Credit Suisse is still down. I think the sentiment there is basically they think that there's significant risk there and no one wants to be out the door. They're seeing what is happening to the additional tier one bondholders, and they might think that equity holders may not get what they deserve as well. There's also some risk that the deal is harder to execute than it seems. And you know, there was very little time to do any due diligence, and it's hard to really value what Credit Suisse is worth, especially some potentially toxic assets that investment bank may hold. So that's why the share price lost a lot of ground.
What's next then for Credit Suisse, knowing that all this is panning out?
So another narrative coming out is that potentially the two banks coming together will be a case of stronger together for the merged entity of UBS and Credit Suisse. The new entity will be the world's fourth largest in assets with over $1.6 trillion. Its wealth and asset management business will be over $5 trillion in assets under management. But the investment bank of Credit Suisse will be significantly shrunk to reduce the exposure to losses and risk. UBS has a much more conservative culture than Credit Suisse, which is why it has the upper hand, and it's the acquirer in this case. There will also be an expectation of significant job cuts. Yesterday, or over the weekend rather, the UBS chairman said it would cut up to $8 billion in costs. And you can bet that will include haircuts.
Okay, I just want to direct you to Credit Suisse share price right now on the screen. I'm not too sure if you can see it, but maybe I can audible it. As you can see, the five-day trending has shown a 62% negative towards share price. But this is a story that is long in the making, because year to date, as you can see on the screen, it is actually down 72%. So it's not something that is new, something that people just, you know, was taken off guard. You know, folks like yourselves, like Stashaway, are you guys shying from banking stocks? Do you feel that there could be much more industries out there to be invested in, and perhaps shy away from the banking industry for now?
Yeah, I think the financial sector is really one for good times. You know, when the cyclical nature of the economy goes back to better times, our positions in our portfolio have been
in a stagflation environment where inflation is still too high, but growth is near negative or at negative. So we prefer more defensive assets like shorter term bonds and also the healthcare sector. So financial sectors was never in the case
coming to a year like today. But I suppose as a whole, you know, if the question is framed around will this banking sector undergo a crisis, not unlike what we've endured in the global financial crisis, this remains to be seen, right? What we are seeing out of US regulators and now the Swiss regulators is to stamp out this fire. And this transaction, in the speed that it was done, signals that the governments in the respective jurisdiction will do whatever it takes. They want to avoid a banking crisis. So while we will see some volatility, especially in weaker names like First Republic or Credit Suisse, there'll be stresses in pockets of the financial system. But it's a good sign that both the governments and the private sector will want to step in. But for our portfolios are concerned, our exposure to the financial sector is very small, and it's not something we're positioned to benefit from.
Also on the screen right now is UBS Group AG's share price. If you can pull that up, as you can see, it is flatlining, if not declining ever so slightly. Today we saw an uptick of about 1%, but generally speaking, year to date, it's still down about 3%. You know, basically trying to tell that whole story of how investors are, like yourselves, might not necessarily be hot for the financial sector right now. Then my follow-up question would be on whether or not the banking of the world is facing some sort of a crisis, at least for the short term for this year. Would you agree to that statement, whether or not the banking is actually facing a crisis right now?
Yeah, I would actually say that what the regulators are trying to do is to avert a crisis. I don't think we are in a crisis as yet. The global financial crisis in 2008 was stemmed from credit. And since then, a lot of safeguards have been put into place to avoid a credit-based crisis. What we're facing now is more of repercussions of how much the Fed has raised rates, which have caused bond holdings to really be devalued significantly. And of course, these bonds, treasuries, which are meant to be safe, are sitting on these banks' balance sheets. And that's why the strength of the balance sheets of these banks are really under question. And a lot of investors are now looking towards weaker banks, banks which have been mishandled like Credit Suisse, to see if there's weakness there. But strong banks will continue to be in good position. It's really a case of a two-tier banking system. The strong will be stronger and the weak will be weaker. So we are not in a crisis just yet, and we are seeing that the governments and the private sector is doing everything it can to avoid a crisis.
All right, let's now focus the conversation towards the banking sector in Malaysia. Banking sector analysts have been reported to say that the latest quarterly earnings reporting for October to December for last year came in mostly within expectations. Hong Leong Investment Bank research analyst Chan Jit Hoong said that the banking sector had delivered commendable quarterly results for the fourth quarter of last year, where the sector saw profit up 5% quarter on quarter due to lower loan provision. And on a yearly basis, the sector's earnings growth was even more impressive, growing at a rate of 20%. This is underpinned, according to these analysts, by smaller impaired loan allowances and positive jaws, the income growth exceeding expense growth. And of course, Chan said that a research note that was published yesterday also agrees with what CGS-CIMB is also arguing, seeing that the banking sector posting slower loan growth for this year with a growth rate of between 4% to 5% compared to 5.7% last year, following the industry's loan growth, which eased further from 5.7% year-on-year. Generally speaking, we're looking at growth that is weak, both household and business loans. Weak leading loan indicators, such as loan applications in January this year, did fall 13.2% year-on-year, and approvals are by 6.1% year-on-year, cementing the research house's weaker loan growth forecast for this sector. So loan growth is weaker. Banegara has held the interest rates twice now. What's the story for the Malaysian banking sector then, Ken?
Yeah. In this case, Malaysia is much more insulated. I think a lot of safeguards were put into place during the Asian financial crisis. So we also saw our banks being very resilient in 2008. And also because we are much more of a regional power as opposed to a globally connected economy, we're not really seeing the contagion effects just yet. And if you look at things happening in Malaysia, the economy is a little bit more buoyant. Of course, there's some issues like inflation, but at least the economy is opened up. At least oil prices are still relatively high. At least still electronic sales and exports are still relatively robust. So we have all these tailwinds which are helping our banking sector, and we're not seeing any credit concerns either. So I think that puts us in good stead.
Now, saying that these are the tailwinds that might help buoy the industry even further, perhaps we can talk about the potential downside risks to the sector. Do you feel that the weaker than expected economic growth globally, especially with the potential risks coming in from the possible recessions in the US and Europe, could cause banks to register higher than expected loan loss provisioning? Do you feel that this could support lower or softer loan growth? What would be some of the issues when it comes to the potential downside risk to the sector, Ken?
I think first and foremost, banks need to look at their holdings and really look at where their treasury positions are at. Fortunately, Malaysian government securities are much more stable in this case because our central bank has not increased rates so drastically. So as long as that treasury mix is still has quality, then it'll be fine. In terms of the downside, yes, you could look at overall lower economic growth and then demand for Malaysian goods, which will lead to less lending or at least risk management of Malaysian banks trying to be cautious and not overlend. But I think those things are also limited because in Malaysia, we're much more exposed to regional powers like China, and China has just recently opened up. We'll probably see more imports from that country and also tourism ramp up. So there are some downside risks, but I think they are contained.
Okay, perhaps we have about 2 or 3 more minutes to talk about Stashaway in Malaysia right now. Of course, Stashaway is an ETF, looking at how we can diversify our investments as well. What is the outlook when it comes to the investment strategy for Stashaway Malaysia, especially when you have launched these kind of flexible portfolios, so to speak? What kind of performances have they been posting, and how do you think this is going to pan out for the rest of the year?
I think this Credit Suisse episode really tells you about the need to have diversified portfolios and not to pick stocks and really try and time the market. We've been proponents of long-term investing since day one, and I think now we are really seeing the benefits of that. We have repositioned our portfolios to take advantage of this high inflationary environment, and we're seeing things like short-term bonds and also gold do very, very well. In the last few weeks, there have been this flight to safety towards gold, and our Stashaway portfolios have benefited from that. Flexible portfolios, on the other hand, are a tool or a feature for our investors to express their investment views. If you have a much more targeted or tactical view towards a particular sector, or you want flexibility when it comes to complementing your existing current holdings with some more broad-based ETFs, that's a perfect tool for you to use to navigate markets. We are, however, still proponents of long-term investing and diversification. And I think this recent episode just points to the fact that you need to be exposed, and you need to be exposed not just to Malaysian equities and bonds, which are inherent in your pension schemes already, and things like ASB, which have decent earnings. But if you want better risk return, you have to diversify your holdings overseas. And while we're looking at issues when it comes to the banking sector, there are still assets out there that can be bullish for your portfolio. We are seeing some improvements when it comes to certain sectors, and I think that should be a good thing for investors in the long term.
I don't want to get into the whole debate of passive investing versus active investing, but many fund managers in emerging markets did show that they can pick and trade stocks based on the research have done a little bit better. And the rapid pace of our technological advancement, especially machine learning, big data, many of the items that, say, Stashaway yourself are doing, can predict future trends, and therefore is another reason why some believe, sorry, I'm one of them, by the way, Ken, who believe that passive investing is often underpinned by better than expected active investing. Because of this, do you feel that this whole debate of active versus passive debate will continue on for the years to come, despite, say, for instance, a 10-15 year track record of performance, and of course that whole asterisk, past performance does not indicate future performance? But where do you feel robo-advisors' future lie when it comes to trying to attract investors, especially retail investors, moving forward?
Yeah, I think robo-advisors' digital investment platforms like Stashaway are perfectly positioned, especially post-COVID, where everything is much more digital. I think today's investor is much more exposed to global trends as well, and therefore understand what it takes to invest overseas gradually, and also in a way that correlates to their risk appetite, of course. So I think that Yes, we are a bit more on the passive side, but I think that bodes well for the long term because active fund managers will be subject to a lot of vagaries, right? They may not have managed money in an inflationary environment such as this, or they may not be macro-led investors, and the macro environment matters more than individual stock picking in this time. So we try not to churn our portfolios too much. We try and position our portfolio in the best way for the current environment. So don't forget there are still recessionary fears out there, especially in the US. So what happens when the economy turns and portfolios need to be repositioned? Traditionally, unit trusts would need you to then switch into more conservative portfolios, and there'll be fees and such and such. So I think when it comes to digital platforms like Stashaway, there's no fees involved when it comes to switching, and you can just ride out the ups and downs of the market with a diversified portfolio.
Thank you very much. That was Wong Wai Kian, Country Manager of Stashaway Malaysia, joining us for this conversation.